Later, from the top of the dunes, Jim watched the longboats rowing back towards the Mew with the final load of produce. It seemed to him that the swells were higher than they had been that morning, and the wind was starting to claw off the tops in a parade of leaping white horses. "God spare us," he said aloud. "If the storm comes up, I'll not be able to get the girl off until it passes." Then he remembered his instructions to her. He had told her to jump overboard at precisely 2 bells in the middle watch. He could not get another message to her to stop her doing that. Would she have the good sense to stay on board if there was a full gale blowing, realizing that he had not been able to keep the rendezvous, or would she throw herself overboard regardless and perish in the darkness? The thought of her drowning in the dark waters struck him like a fist in his belly, and he felt nauseous. He turned Drumfire's head towards the castle and pressed his heels into the horse's sides. Captain Hugo was surprised but pleased to have his commission paid so promptly. Jim left him without ceremony, refusing even a mug of coffee, and galloped back along the beach. He was thinking furiously as he rode. There had been so little time to lay his plans. It was only in the last few hours that he had been sure the girl had the spirit to chance such a hazardous escape. The first consideration, if he succeeded in getting her ashore, would be to find a safe hiding place for her. As soon as her escape was discovered, the entire castle garrison would be sent out to find her, 100 infantry and squadron of cavalry. The company troops in the castle had little enough employment, and a manhunt, or better still a woman hunt, would be one of the most exciting events in years. Colonel Kayser, the garrison commander, would be hot for the honour of capturing an escaped convict. For the first time he allowed himself to consider the consequences if this harebrained scheme fell to pieces. He worried that he might be making trouble for his family. The strict law laid down by the directors of the VOC, the almighty 17, in Amsterdam, was that no foreigner was permitted to reside or carry on a business in the colony. However, like so many other strict laws of the directors in Amsterdam, there were special circumstances by which they could be circumvented. Those special circumstances always involved a monetary token of esteem to His Excellency Governor Funder of Witten. It had cost the Courtney brothers 20,000 guilders to obtain a license to reside and trade in the colony of Good Hope. Funder Witten was unlikely to revoke that license. He and Tom Courtney were on friendly terms, and Tom contributed generously to Funder Witten's unofficial pension fund. Jim hoped that if he and the girl simply disappeared from the colony, there would be nothing to implicate the rest of his family. There might be suspicions, and at the worst it might cost his father another gift to Funder Witten, but in the end it would blow over just as long as he never returned. There were only 2 avenues of escape from the colony. The natural and best was the sea, but that meant a boat. The Courtney brothers owned 2 armed traders, handy and fleet schooners with which they traded as far as Arabia and Bombay. However, at the present time, both these vessels were at sea and were not expected back until the monsoon changed, which would not be for several months yet. Jim had saved up a little money, perhaps enough to pay for a passage for the girl and himself on one of the ships lying in Table Bay at the moment, but the first thing Colonel Kayser would do as soon as the girl was reported missing was to send search parties aboard every ship. He could try to steal a small boat, a pinnace, perhaps, something seaworthy enough in which he and the girl could reach the Portuguese ports on the Mozambique coast, but every captain was alert for piracy. The most likely reward for his efforts would be a musket ball in his belly. Even in his most optimistic expectations, he had to face the fact that the sea route was closed to them. There was only 1 other still open, and he turned and looked northwards at the far mountains on which the last of the winter snows had not yet thawed. He pulled up Drumfire and thought about what lay out there. Jim had not travelled more than 50 leagues beyond those peaks, but he had heard of others who had gone further into the hinterland and returned with a great store of ivory. There was even a rumour of the old hunter who had picked a shiny pebble out of a sandbank of a nameless river far to the north, and had sold the diamond in Amsterdam for 100,000 guilders. He felt his skin prickle with excitement. On countless nights he had dreamed of what lay beyond that blue horizon. He had discussed it with Mansur and Zama, and they had promised each other that one day they would make the journey. Had the gods of adventure overheard his boasts, and were they conspiring now to drive him out there into the wilderness? Would he have a girl with golden hair and blue eyes riding at his side? He laughed at the thought and urged Drumfire on. With his father, his uncle Dorian, and almost all the servants and freed slaves out of the way for the next few hours, he had to work quickly. He knew where his father kept the keys to both the strong room and the armory. He selected 6 strong mules out of the herd in the kraal, pack-saddled them, and took them on a lead rein up to the rear doors of the godown. He had to choose carefully as he selected goods from the warehouse to make up the loads. 12 best tower muskets and canvas ball pouches, kegs of black powder and lead bars and moulds to cast more ball, axes, knives and blankets, beads and cloth to trade with the wild tribes they might meet, basic medicines, pots and water bottles, needles and thread, and all the other necessities of existence in the wilderness, but no luxuries. Coffee was not a luxury, he consoled himself, as he added a sack of beans. When they were loaded, he led the string of mules away to a quiet place beside a stream in the forest almost 2 miles from High Weald. He relieved the animals of their packs so they could rest, and left them with knee halters to allow them to graze on the lush grass on the stream bank. By the time he returned to High Weald, the longboats were on their way back from the Mew. He went down to meet his father, Mansur, and the returning crews as they came back over the dunes. He rode along with them and listened to their desultory conversation. They were all drenched with seawater and almost exhausted, for it had been a long haul back from the Dutch ship in the heavy seas. Mansur described it to him succinctly. "You were lucky to get out of it. The waves were breaking over us like a waterfall." "Did you see the girl?" Jim whispered, so his father would not overhear. "What girl?" Mansur gave him a knowing glance. "You know what girl?" Jim punched his arm. Mansur's expression turned serious. "They had all the convicts locked up and battened down. One of the officers told Uncle Tom that the captain is anxious to sail as soon as he can finish reprovisioning and filling his water butts. By tomorrow at the very latest. He does not want to be pinned down by the storm on this lee shore." He saw Jim's despairing expression and went on sympathetically, "Sorry, cuz, but like as not the ship will be gone by noon tomorrow. She would have been no good for you anyway, a convict woman. You know nothing about her. You don't know what crime she's committed. Murder, perhaps. Let her go, Jim. Forget about her. There's more than one bird in the blue sky, more than a single blade of grass on the plains of Camdebu." Jim felt anger flare and bitter words rose to his lips, but he held them back. He left the others and turned Drumfire towards the top of the dunes. From the height he looked out across the bay. The storm was mounting even as he watched, bringing on the darkness prematurely. The wind moaned and ruffled his hair and whipped Drumfire's mane into a tangle. He had to shield his eyes against the sting of flying sand and spume. The surface of the sea was a welter of breaking white spray and tall, heaving swells that rose up and crashed down on the beach. It was a wonder that his father had been able to bring the boats in through that turmoil of wind and water. But Tom Courtney was a master mariner. Almost 2 miles out, the Mew was an indistinct grey shape that rolled and pitched with swinging bare masts and disappeared as each fresh squall swept across the bay. Jim watched until the darkness hid her completely. Then he galloped down the back of the dune towards High Weald. He found Zama still working in the stables, bedding down the horses. "Come with me," he ordered. And obediently Zama followed him out into the orchard. When they were out of sight of the house, they squatted down side by side. They were silent for a while. Then Jim spoke in Lhotse, the language of the forests, so that Zama would know there were deadly serious matters to discuss. "I am going," he said. Zama stared into his face, but his eyes were hidden by the darkness. "Where, Somoya?" he asked. Jim pointed with his chin towards the north. "When will you return?" "I do not know. Perhaps never," said Jim. "Then I must take leave of my father." "You're coming with me?" Jim asked. Zama glanced at him pityingly. No answer was needed to such a fatuous question. "Aboli was a father to me also." Jim stood up and placed an arm around his shoulder. "Let us go to his grave." They climbed the hill in the intermittent lightning flashes, but they both had the night vision of youth, so they went swiftly. The grave was on the eastern slope, sited deliberately to face each morning sunrise. Jim remembered every detail of the funeral. Tom Courtney had slaughtered a black bull, and Abilene's wives had stitched the old man's corpse into the wet hide. Then Tom had carried Abilene's once great body, shrunken now with age like a sleeping child, down into the deep shaft. He had sat him upright, then laid out all his weapons and his most treasured possessions around him. Lastly, the entrance to the shaft was sealed with a round boulder. It had taken two full spans of oxen to drag it into position. Now, in the darkness, Jim and Zama knelt before it and prayed to the tribal gods of the Lhotse, and to Abuli, who in death had joined that dark pantheon. The rolling thunder counterpointed their prayers. Zama asked his father for his blessing on the journey that lay ahead of them. Then Jim thanked him for teaching him the way of the musket and the sword, and reminded Abuli of when he had taken him to hunt his first lion. "Protect us, your sons, as you shielded us that day," he asked, "for we go upon a journey we know not where." Then the two sat with their backs against the gravestone, and Jim explained to Zama what he must do. "I've loaded a string of mules. They are tethered by the stream. Take them up into the mountains to Majuba, the place of doves, and wait for me there." Majuba was the rude hut hidden in the foothills that was used by the shepherds who took the Courtney flocks up to the high pastures in the summer, and by the men of the Courtney family when they went out to hunt the quagga, the eland, and the bluebuck. It was deserted at this season of the year. They said their last farewells to the old warrior who sat eternally in the darkness behind the boulder, and went down to the clearing beside the stream in the forest. Jim took a lantern from one of the packs, and by its light helped Zama load the mules with the heavy packs. Then he set him on the path that led northwards into the mountains. "I will come in 2 days, whatever happens. Wait for me," Jim shouted as they parted, and Zama rode on alone. By the time Jim arrived back at High Wheel, the household was asleep, but Sarah, his mother, had kept his dinner warm for him on the back of the stove. When she heard him clattering the pots, she came down in her nightgown and sat to watch him eat. She said little, but her eyes were sad, and there was a droop at the corners of her mouth. "God bless you, my son, my only son," she whispered, as she kissed him good night. Earlier that day she had seen him lead away the mule train into the forest, and with a mother's instinct she had known he was leaving. She picked up the candle and climbed the stairs to the bedroom, where Tom snored peacefully.